Open a public hearing on House Bill 3633.
Hello, Chair Starr. My name is Harvey Matthews. I work for the Speaker of the House, Lynn Snodgrass, and Education Policy. And I am pleased to bring you today House Bill 3633, Project Success for Oregon's Educational Future. It has some unique features. It links Oregon's education system from K through 16 instead of K-12. It clarifies the roles of elected officials and helps them clarify what their goals are in the overall scheme of education in Oregon. And it also creates accountability measurements that this group will all agree on and for all levels of education. Primary strength is the involvement of parents and teachers at every step of the process, and it is the goal of this project success that at the end of it we'll have 5 to 10 goals that the education leadership team will pick as Oregon's focus for education accountability. At this point, I'd love to entertain any questions you might have.
Questions for the witness.
There have been a number of attempts to do something like this over the years. How does this differ from any of the rest of them?
Chair Starr and Senator Duke, I think this is a very unique attempt to try and understand education accountability because of the people that are in this. Speaker is not the main person leading this charge. It will be the Superintendent of Public Instruction and the 7 other elected leaders, the Governor, the Commissioner of Bureau of Labor and Industries, the Commissioner of Community Colleges, Speaker of the House, the President of the Senate, and the Commissioner or the Chancellor of Higher Education. Those 7 members, because of their political clout, and because they have to agree on the issues affecting education that they want to focus on, I think that this will actually produce results instead of just producing another report that sits on a shelf.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Is there anyone else? Anyone else desire to testify on House Bill 3633.
Thank you.
Lori and Greg, thank you. Kevin Forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For your record, Greg McMurdo, representing the State Superintendent of Public Instruction. We want to compliment the Speaker on bringing this bill forward, but we do have a concern, and unfortunately it's around money. I think that's a very common concern around this building this time of year. It has been for as many years as I've been here. We just want to make note that we believe that the summit that is called for in the bill needs to be funded. As our understanding, currently there are no funds identified for that purpose. So we would ask that you consider at least providing funding through the State Emergency Board if no other funds are available for purposes of financing the summit. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for Greg?
I agree with him.
Thank you, sir.
Good afternoon. For the record, Lori Wimmer, the Oregon Education Association, and we too support the bill as it's passed, although we do also have one concern, and I was trying desperately to find it in my dash four amendments, but I didn't locate the exact phrase to reference, but I'll try to do that in a few minutes. The bill as it's written directs the e-board to make determinations about successful school programs and potentially allocate monies to those schools that are designated as such. And that, as you may remember, in 1997, this body passed the successful schools law of, that does essentially the same thing that this bill contemplates in that section, and directs the Department of Education to make that evaluation and allocation by grant. And we believe that given that that law is already in place, that this ought to reference that statute rather than create a new layer on top of it that replicates those efforts, and that those policy determinations ought to be made by the Department of Education as is in statute rather than by the e-board, which is a body that's meant to appropriate, not make policy. But with that, we do support the bill otherwise.
Thank you very much. Other questions? Thank you very much.
What's your amendment?
That we reference the Department of Education program that's already existing and give them the ability to make this grant.
Could you consider where that might fit?
Mr. Chair, Lori Wimmer, in the original bill, it was, I believe, on the fourth page under subsection 6 and section 3, and I'm still struggling to reference it off my dashboard. And maybe Harvey knows what that is. We talked about it before. Yeah. Actions that the e-board may take that allocate additional resources to high-performing schools. That's where it would be. And I would defer to Cindy Hunt's good judgment on how best to reword that.
There you go. We should set this over for a work session on tomorrow. We have a meeting scheduled at 3 for tomorrow.
For the next day?
For the next day. Now listen.
It's just seen, Mr. Chair, that if we already have the Department of Education dealing with this issue, that it would make sense to reference that and allow them to continue dealing it with it for this project, too. And I have utmost faith in Cindy Hunt that she would be able to draft something to that effect. If staff would ask her to speak for a moment.
I would like to investigate that at least and reschedule it for work session.
Before you close that, I'd like to say something.
Would you please go ahead?
Please, okay. It's a little bit like Abraham Lincoln said. It's not what I don't understand about the Bible that gives me concern. It's what I understand they don't do. And I absolutely do not think we need another education leadership team when they're not picked out of education experts. These people, politicians, gave us a school reform that didn't have a record of success in any place in the world. And here we're going to put together and waste a bunch of other money from the President of the Senate. What's his credentials? The governor. Bureau of Labor and Industry is going to make our kids worker bees. Chancellor of State Board of Higher Ed. And I think the last thing we need is another big team to go over this, unless they would do education again, unless they would do one thing. If they would take and make trade missions to North Dakota, Iowa, New Jersey, the states where those kids top the charts every time on national standardized tests
and import what's working in the other states. For us to put together and waste taxpayers' money and take it from the feds, another study is ridiculous. And I think it's wrong. The last speaker had their education and went around. Guess what? We came back, they weren't speaker again. He wasn't. And nothing was implemented. And what is it? The prize for being speaker, you get to spend a bunch of public money studying education again? I mean, it's ridiculous. I'm a no, and I'd do anything to stall it. So, I guess I said it. It's a waste of money.
Close the work of the public hearing on House Bill 3633, and open a work session on Senate Bill 1337.
No, she's
Mr. Chair and members, Senate Bill 1337 provides that if House Bill 2082 is referred to the people by petition, then 2082 will be voted on at the May 2000 primary election. And 2082C, as currently written, increases the gas tax and used fuel tax, changes the weight mile tax tables, and weight mile and flat fee tax amounts. House Bill 2082, as currently written, also increases the passenger vehicle registration fee. So all 1337 does provides that House Bill 2082, if referred to the people, will be voted on at the May 2000 primary election.
Discussion?
I'll be voting no.
You'll be voting no.
This is 2082.
Mr. Shannon, yes. Would you help us with the understanding of what House Bill 2082 is? The potential referral, we're talking about making this a referral.
Well, you know, I don't have it here.
What is this? This is 1337.
It's the
primary. If you're 2082, which I think is a bill that hasn't been written yet.
Well, sure, that's a gas tax increase.
That's why we need your attention.
Would yeah, you do.
About it?
Okay. I'm still fuming over the last one. Okay, let's see here.
Could I ask a question?
Please.
Why is it we're going to deal with tax increases at a primary election when we know the turnout tends to be minuscule?
Is
there a reason?
No.
No?
Oh. Here's the situation. There is a rumor that if we send out a 5-cent gas tax increase, there's a certain political body that's going to refer, get our signatures and refer it to the people.
This is assuming it didn't happen.
Right.
Okay.
And so, now, isn't this the one that is about?
Because if they refer it, then it goes to the ballot. No.
Yeah. So that the construction people could start, you know, that they could get ready instead of waiting until November. I think that was, they wanted to do it, and it shall be referred to the people for their approval or rejection at the primary.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to be a no on this. The first assumption we have to make is that the bill can clear the legislature, which it seems to be having some difficulty with. And then we have to make the next assumption that somebody can refer to the ballot and get enough signatures to get it on the ballot. And then we're going to tell them which ballot they can put it on. I mean, Oregonians love the initiative petition and recall sections of the Oregon Constitution, and it just seems that we shouldn't be standing in the middle of it and say, okay, if you can get enough signatures, then you have to put it on this particular ballot rather than the one it would normally go into.
Would you would you wait until somebody said, you know, somebody asked for the right if they could testify to it? I'll have my staff bring somebody. But I will, just for the one that doesn't observe everything that's going on. This could be an indication that the gas tax A will pass tomorrow, and then we get to go to gas tax B. So I'm glad.
Huh?
I hope you get your pocket.
You have to read the book for the safety of my day.
We are going to recess. Back to the floor. We can conduct some business there. We will. We'll be back sometime between now and 5 o'clock. I think. Public prayers. We're going to we're going to open a work session on House Bill 2406. Okay, got everybody here. All right, Steve.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee. First thing, there's a housekeeping issue. On the C-7 union, legislative council right now is drafting C-8 amendment, line 23, where it says ORS 197.763, there needs to be a subparagraph 1, a 1 in parentheses. It's on your dance C-7 amendment, line 23.
It can't be
that's one. Yeah, sure. Oh, I'm just housekeeping, so you know, and I'll carry on the preliminary staff measure summary is referencing the dash C7. If we can keep in mind that those will be definitely dash C8 unless council gets the amendment to us while we're up there. And with that, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the amendments we're referencing insert text House Bill 2474 being gross. Addressing concerns raised by the Attorney General's office over a portion of that measure. According to the advocates of House Bill 2474B, the measure passed both legislative chambers and was awaiting governor's signature when the Attorney General's office raised concerns over the raise or waive appeal provision of the measure. The concern raised was that the measure didn't specify that land use issues need to be raised locally prior to appeal to the Land Use Board of Appeals, commonly known as LUBA, or the circuit court, thereby negating other statutes requiring this action. Clarifications made in paragraph 3 of the amendment require landowners to raise land use issues to their local planning commission in order to be eligible for appeal regarding a land use decision. Appeals may be made to LUBA or the circuit court, depending on who has the jurisdiction.
You understand the amendment we need, the textual amendment?
Yes. Would you like a motion?
I would like a motion.
Mr. Chair, I will move that we conceptually amend the dash C7 amendment to HB 2406 in adding 1 in parentheses on line 23, page 1 of the amendment, following ORS 197.76. 3, which will be followed by 1 in parentheses.
You've heard the conceptual amendment in discussion. Any objections? Porter.
Mr. Chair, I will move the dash C amendment, C7 amendment, as conceptually amended, page 2406.
Senator Wiles has moved the dash C7 amendment as conceptually amended to House Bill 2406. Further discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
I will move HB 2406 as amended to the floor to pass recommendation.
Senator Wilde has moved HB 2406 as amended to the floor to pass recommendation. Further discussion? First call the roll.
Senator Duke?
Aye.
Senator Shannon?
Aye.
Senator Tarrell?
Aye.
Senator Wilde?
Aye.
Senator
Thompson? Aye. I receive the necessary majority. House Bill 2406 moved before to be passed recommendation. Carrier?
Okay.
A while ago, carry. Thank you. When I recessed, we were in a work session, and I really didn't take us out of that work session before we recessed. And then I failed to remind myself of that. We were in a work session on Senate Bill 1337 when we recessed, and we're going to go back to that now and reopen the work session on 1337. And we'd like Mark Nelson to tell us why that
election chairman member of the committee. My name is Mark Nelson, Public Affairs Council, representing Associated Oregon Industries. And discussions over the last several months concerning the gas tax proposal, some of the discussion has been if it is going to be referred, which there are elements of the opposition who have indicated that they want to refer this measure, and that process would occur over the next really 90 to 180 days. If it was referred, automatically is referred unless the legislature otherwise specifies to the November general election. Those of us who are supporting the package that moved out today would like to see that vote occur earlier, because obviously if it occurred in May and we were successful in that in passage of the package, the dollars would start moving sooner to the projects, both in terms of the bond projects that you know is identified at $600 million, and the diesel tax would be implemented sooner. So our desire is to try to cause those dollars to move up as fast as possible. We clearly would not like to see the referral, but if it's referred, we'd like to see it voted on earlier than November of 2000.
Bear in mind that I'm tired. Is it the Constitution that says which election a petition will be asked?
The Chairman, Senator Duke, yes, the Constitution says...
The bill amends the Constitution. I thought, it says it enacted by people of the state of Oregon, so we're going to run a bill out to amend the Constitution for one election?
No. Mr. Chairman, Senator Duke, this is not, unless it's improperly drafted, this simply, if the constitutional amendment is referred, then it would be voted on at the May primary.
Referred by the people?
No, referred, yes, referred by...
You mean referred by the legislature?
No, referred by the people.
Okay.
The Constitution now states that if a measure is referred by the people, then a legislative measure is referred by the people, then it would appear on the November general election ballot following that referral, unless otherwise specified by the legislature. And so this bill is the otherwise specification by the legislature to appear in May.
Have we ever done this before?
Mr. Chairman, I believe so. There have been many measures that have been referred by the legislature to...
No, I'm talking about have we ever taken... Have we, the legislature, ever chosen the election at which an initiative petition would be voted on?
I believe we have. I think we did it in one sales tax, which was not successful.
And I'd just like to say that what I learned in the hearings on the gas tax and the diesel tax is that you have to give 6 months' notice if you're going to switch to a diesel. So if we did it in May, they would be able by January 1, and if they do it later, it wouldn't be for the next July. So it helps if we do it for planning, because other states have to make some changes.
Mr. Chairman, thanks for chatting. That's correct.
Mm-hmm.
Further questions? We're in a work session.
Okay, I move Senate Bill 1337 to the floor with the due pass.
Senator Shannon has moved Senate Bill 1337 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion? Clerk, call the roll.
Senator Duke?
No.
Senator Shannon?
Aye.
Senator Ricardo?
Aye.
Senator Wild?
No.
Senator Scott?
Aye. Having received the necessary majority, Senate Bill 1337 moves forward to be passed recommendations. Senator right. Shannon.
Okay.
Sure.
Okay, sure. Well, on the whole thing, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
It just makes it strange. The bill hasn't even seen the floor yet to be voted on, and we're already picking the election date for the initiative petition that will. He filed and got enough signatures in opposition to the bill that hasn't been voted on yet.
Well, he prepared the old Boy Scout model.
I guess he passed one of these to any of our controversial bills that we send out.
Alrighty. We're going to open a work session on possible reconsideration of House Bill 2140.
The bill you're sending out.
We have a person somewhere. We're in a work session.
Mr. Sure, I move to
Senator Charnel has moved that we suspend the rules that we might reconsider the vote by which House Bill 2140 was sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Clerk, call the roll.
Aye.
Senator Shannon?
Aye.
Senator Charles?
Aye.
Senator Wells?
Aye.
Aye. I received that we are the motion passed. Now we the motion to.
Sure, I move to reconsider the vote by which House Bill 2140 was sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Carno has moved to reconsider the vote by which House Bill 2140 was sent to the floor for the due pass recommendation. Is that a debatable motion?
No.
Clerk, call the roll.
Senator Duke?
Aye.
Senator Shannon?
Aye.
Senator Carno?
Aye.
Senator Wild?
Aye.
Aye. Motion carried. We now have House Bill 2140 before.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the reason that we have to bring this bill back to the committee is that we found out after we passed it that we have some conflict amendments. This is the -D14 amendments you should have in your packet, and I highlighted one change that was made. These amendments clarify that OLCC will decide on imposing sanctions based on businesses that are violating laws of the state that prohibit sales of alcoholic beverages to minors. So that's all we're doing. We're highlighted on page 2. So just clarify by adding language for selling alcoholic beverages to a minor. It's a conflict amendment.
Anything else? Questions?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Duke.
It wasn't here the day the bill originally reached the hearing on it, so I'm kind of going off staff initial summary and what little I know of oil fields we are. But doesn't the dash B14 say that you can't take into consideration complaints filed for selling alcoholic beverages to a minor when you're considering whether or not to impose sanctions on somebody who has continued to sell alcoholic beverages to minors?
Except that the operation has to have not been conducted pursuant to uniform standards and practices, if you continue on.
It goes sold to a minor.
We have someone who can answer the question. Mr. Moore. Mr. Martin Olson.
Okay. I feel like you actually came up.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mark Nelson, representing 7-Eleven. This particular section, we call the whole bill sort of carrot and stick approach. And we've agreed to increasing the fine from $2,000 to $5,000. At the same time, the OLCC has agreed to set up a program by which vendors or by which licensees participate. And in participating in that program, if one of our clerks does sell to a minor, the measure says that if we are participating in the full program, then the OLCC would not cancel the license for that violation. Now, that's only related to a violation for sale to a minor, and if the licensee is participating in the program established by OLCC. If there are other violations of the liquor control statutes, the licensee could and would lose their license.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dukes, for the record, Barb Hutchison from the Liquor Commission. Senator Dukes, I think you asked whether or not we would listen to complaints. I think that particular section is actually a section out of Senate Bill 115 that Senator Rimsdale. And it has to do with uniform decoy operations so that if a local law enforcement agency is not following uniform standards using minors who in fact look like minors and they're not using fake ID, and we have a number of things, that standards that we have imposed. And what this bill says, if a local law enforcement agency is not going by our standards, then we will not categorize that as a violation because it is in traffic.
Do you consider that to be a conflict resolution?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, I don't know why all of this is in here. I think the committee administrator marked just a few places that needed to be fixed, and I thought that was the conflict resolution, the conflict amendment. But this is the language that actually is in Senator Lynn's bill, which is Senate Bill 115.
What's the process today, Barb? If I'm in a liquor store and one of my employees sells to a minor, and that can all be verified or whatever, and you take action, what action do you take?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, we have a penalty schedule. At this point, it is only the licensee that really is held responsible. It is not a very adequate way of getting at the clerk.
I figured I'd fire him.
Senator, that's generally what happens. One of the things that we would like to be able to do is to require training of these clerks. As you know, bartenders and servers all must go through mandatory server training. And we have no such provision that allows us to get at clerks who are selling alcoholic beverages. This new program, as outlined in this responsible vendor program in 2140, will allow us to get to some of these clerks in the stores.
So
So if my employee gets training, I don't get fined.
Mr. Shiro, Senator Deuce, we will have to work out the specifics of the responsible vendor program by rule, but there will be a number of provisions that a licensee will have to adhere to, and if they, we may say, fall off the wagon, then they would lose this special privilege of not being canceled. They can still be fined over and over. We can suspend their license, and as Mr. Nelson said, under any other alcohol beverage violations, we can still cancel their license.
So what happens if I don't fire the employee and they do it again? They've taken the training, they do it again, then what happens?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, we haven't worked out all of the particulars, but right now somebody can get four violations and they could be up for cancellation. The other thing
is this, at any point do we get the cancellation?
Yes, there it is. If things get bad and, you know, they're not adhering to the program, what we are finding generally is that when somebody gets up to the third violation level, they either go out of business or they get their act together. In the last 2 years, we canceled one license and one license only, and it was not because the clerk sold to a minor, it was because the licensee sold to a minor.
Question. Mr. Chair, I move the conflict amendment B14 to the left. Senator Carnell has moved the dash B14 amendments to House Bill 2140. Any further discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, to order.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2140 as amended before the Zupan's recommendation.
Senator Carnell is moving House Bill 2140. As amended to the floor to do pass recommendations. Clerk, call the roll.
Senator Duke?
Aye.
Senator Shannon?
Aye.
Senator Lucado?
Aye.
Senator Wild?
Aye.
Sheriff Carr?
Aye. I received the necessary majority. House Bill 2140 is moved to the floor to do pass recommendation. We have a carrier.
I think I was already.
You already designated. Okay. Senator Carnell will. Great. Thank you. We're going to move. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2830. Representative Carr. Peter DeLuca coming with Representative Krupp. No?
And Mr. Chair, if Brian Doherty also. Otherwise, we're known as the Three Amigos.
All right. We're getting late in the day, folks.
Mr. Chair,
why we need this?
I promise you that we will be brief. For the record, I'm State Representative Jeff Krupp, House District 37. I want to thank you and members of the committee for being willing to hear us. Basically, you have a little sheet on your desk saying what the purpose of House Bill 2830 is and why the bill is needed. And you're welcome to look at that. Why do we need to do this is because we want to put in the statute the concept that Oregon OSHA is now heading in terms of their inspections process, which is very similar to what the federal government is doing in terms of the direction of putting the emphasis on prioritizing inspections to most of the time, and I qualify that, predominantly as it says in the bill, to try to visit the most dangerous workplaces that have a history of injuring workers or industries that also have a history of that type of thing. We have worked very, very long and hard with the OSHA administrator, I'm saying that correctly now, I've been referring to him as director for a long time now, and I want to be proper in that regard. He appreciates the promotion, but it's improper. We've worked very long and hard with him, as Brian Doherty has. We've worked with numerous groups to refine this bill to meet everyone's desires and come up with a concept that is very, very workable, that allows the agency to go in the direction that they're currently heading, not hogtie them or tie their hands so that they can't complete their mission, but yet make very, very clear that the mission and the direction they're headed is certainly proper. We want to make sure that they continue to do that for many years to come. What does this bill do? Well, it establishes that OSHA will develop their own, and Mr. DeLuca will speak to this, their own inspection schedule based on what's considered a worst-first basis first. This allows random inspections. It simply says that that the agency will develop some methodology behind those random inspections, and Mr. DeLuca can expand on that later. But also, one of the things that we really thought was important, that OSHA has a great program in effect right now, Oregon OSHA does, in regards to consultative services, that with businesses like my own can take advantage of those consultative services and not be in fear of the agency. For many years, so many of us have been afraid to have an OSHA inspector ever show up at our door. Because, take for instance my farm, I simply don't know all of the laws and the rules that are necessary or current that Oregon OSHA is following. So I've always been afraid to have them come aboard because they might find something wrong and I would get fined for simply not knowing something out of blissful ignorance on the farm. So what we're hoping to do is to allow the agency to send out notifications to industries that are in a high hazard classification that they may be inspected. Now what that says to me as a business owner is that farming has been identified as a high hazard industry and that I might be inspected. And what that means to me is that I have got to keep my act together. I've got to do a good job and not let my guard down and get lazy about worker protection and somebody gets hurt. We think this is a great concept, a great idea, and we also in the bill do one thing that's very, very important, is that we stipulate that investigations need to be completed within 180 days of the time of an accident. And this is important because it has led to some serious problems, some litigation over the years, and other issues as a result of investigations being drawn out over a period of time. This is also in conclusion with the federal law that's out there currently, where they try to have their investigations done in 180 days also. So what we're trying to do here is just ensure a safer workplace by focusing on OSHA's limited resources. Keep in mind, this great agency only has the ability to inspect about 5 to 8% of Oregon businesses a year. So we think it's very important that they focus on industries where people are getting hurt instead of perhaps wasting time doing inspections where there really isn't a dangerous opportunity for someone to get hurt. I'll give you an example of this. OSHA some years ago did an inspection in my local fire department. They spent 6 hours there, found no violations essentially. And 6 hours that could have been spent, I think, in a very dangerous workplace, making sure that that the proper standards are being met. Everyone has recognized that in the work group that this is an important direction for us to go. To the agency's credit, they put together a work group of over 130 people early on to address this and many other issues in terms of making OSHA be a little more efficient and a little more user-friendly to the business community and still allow the protections to workers to occur, and allow the agency to work efficiently and productively out there because they do have limited resources. So with that, I will turn the bulk of my time to my two compatriots. Peter?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm going to be brief, but I want to talk a little bit about what the bill does and what it doesn't do.
It captures the concept of worst first, and it says that we will concentrate our efforts predominantly in the worst workplaces, both in terms of industry, dangerous industries, and also in terms of employers that have records that indicate that they're injuring a higher number of people than other employers are. But we've also, over the years, inspected other workplaces which don't fall in that category, and we think that's important just to keep people on their toes. And so that's what the portion of the bill that speaks to random inspections, which are not based on high hazards or high incident rates, is about. So we'll be focusing on worst first, but we will also retain the ability to do random inspections, and that's been very important as we went through this process. It's important to us. It's important to the unions, and it's also very important to some of the larger private employers, because they feel that keeps them on their toes as well. It provides, the bill does, that we will provide notification to people who are in those higher hazard areas, both in terms of their records and also in terms of being in a high hazard industry. But it does not require everybody to get a notification, and the fact that someone might not be notified because we don't know their current address or some other reason like that would not nullify any inspection that we do. The purpose of the notification is to allow those employers the opportunity to say, well, gee, maybe I should take a second look at my safety program and make things better. I think that with respect to notification particularly, you can expect that we will need to do some rulemaking in order to set forth exactly how we will provide these notices and how often. The bill provides that an employer may retain an attorney to be an employer representative in its inspection process. And we believe that in all likelihood they can already do that, but this will clarify a gray area and allow people to go ahead and hire an attorney if that's what they want to do. These attorneys, though, would then function as an employer representative, as all other employer representatives do in our inspection, and not be legal counsel for purposes of that inspection, but rather be the employer representative. So we would expect that all other things that apply to any other employer representative would apply to an attorney slash employer representative in that process, including they need to be helpful in part of the process, trying to help us to find out what's going on in that workplace as opposed to preventing us from finding out. And they also they need to be reasonably available. We don't allow people to put off an inspection because an employer representative is not available, and because one may happen to be a lawyer, we wouldn't allow that to put off an inspection either. The purpose of the inspection being to get into the workplace and find out what's wrong, not to give an employer a couple of weeks to fix things before we get there. So with those additional comments, and those are my understandings about this bill, I'd have to say in closing, this has been an interesting process. We started out, we had a lot of contention about it. Representative Krupp has been just wonderful to work with in terms of trying to work all of these things out. We've come up with, I think, a bill that is now good for business, it's good for labor, and it's good for Oregon OSHA. And we urge your favorable consideration.
Members of the committee, I'm Brian Doherty, and I'll be very brief. I represent employers on OSHA citations in my legal life. I'm a partner with the Miller Nash Law Firm, so when I'm not down here, I'm doing other type of law. I do this work. I've been asked to help them draft this, and with the good help of Mr. DeLuca, Representative Krupp, and Senator Dirkler, and others, and we've worked with the labor unions, with many people, to get a bill that's workable. I'll just give you the 3 points, I think, of why I think it's a good bill and it's a good idea to pass it. One, it focuses limited resources on the worst first employers. Everybody knows it, though. You all fill out OSHA 200 logs in your businesses, people can find it. This will focus limited resources on the places that need it the most, while giving OSHA the ability to still conduct random inspections anywhere. But from the employer's perspective, and one of the key things that we fight about, it seems, in OSHA inspections, are all employers think they've been picked on when OSHA shows up. This says you shall use mutual administrative criteria to conduct those other type of random inspections. In other words, there can be some basis. It's not a basis made by the compliance officer sitting there on lunch break, but it's being made by Pizza Luca down in Salem saying this is how we're going to go after random inspections. So you got to load the resources. The other thing I like is you have notice provisions. You tell the people that have high injury rates, you've got a heightened likelihood we're going to be showing up. I don't care what their motivation is to get better. If that works, great. And we'll tell you, we've got consultative services, so we'll tell you where we can help you get better. And I think that's a very good carrot and stick approach. It should work. We hope it does. I think this is a benchmark bill. We hope to come back in 2001 and see that these things are helping. As I said, we've got support, I think, of a broad range of groups. So we'd urge your passage. We also have the -A9 amendments. And I think all of us were testifying to this bill with the -A9 amendments, and we'd encourage you to pass those as well.
Mr. Chair, in closing, I do want to thank these two fine gentlemen for putting in a lot of time and a lot of hours on this issue, plus numerous other individuals from the unions and certainly other people. The A9 amendments are amendments that we've all agreed to. We think they're very important. They are the final amendments to the bill. They do set forth the course that we are asking for in this bill. We urge that you would move them into this bill and move this bill to the Senate floor for a due pass. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Lisa, what's up? Love you, good bill to death.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Lisa Trussell with Associated Oregon Industries, just here to offer our support for House Bill 2830. We appreciate the work that Representative Cross put into it in working with people's concerns, and we think the bill that you have before you with the -9 amendments is a good bill, and we'd encourage your support. Thank you.
Question. Thank you very much. Anyone else have to testify on the bill? Not to close the public hearing, open work session on House Bill 2830.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the -A9 amendments to...
Senator Wild has moved the -A9 amendments to House Bill 2830. Discussion? Objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
I will move HB 2830 as amendments for the pass recommendation.
Senator Wild has moved House Bill 2830 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Clerk, call the roll.
Senator Duke?
Aye.
Senator Carno?
Aye.
Senator Wild?
Aye.
Chair
Stubbs? Aye. I received the necessary majority. House Bill 2830 moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Carrier, Senator Wild will carry. Senator Shannon, do you have a desire to vote on House Bill 2830, the OSHA?
Well, I don't care. Yes, I am. Thanks for the opportunity.
We're opening public hearing on House Bill 3492. Representative Barbara Ross.
Good afternoon, Senator. I'm Barbara Ross, a state representative from Corvallis, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify. It's my understanding that another bill is being amended, and that now House Bill 3492 includes the prohibition against regulating smoking in bars and taverns. I'm opposed to this regulation because I think that we should leave this to the local community. Our community, Corvallis, had a long debate about prohibiting smoking in any indoor business. They spent a long time debating this. They passed out the ordinance that included bars and restaurants, and ultimately that section of the ordinance was referred to the voters, and the voters in our community did affirm the fact that they did not want smoking in any public place, including bars and restaurants. Now, this particular amendment does exclude Corvallis because it indicates it wouldn't apply to any municipality that had passed such a regulation prior to January 1, 1999. And we appreciate that, but at the same time we think that it is important for local jurisdictions to be able to make their own decisions, to go through their own process, to allow their own citizens to vote on issues such as this. And I am disturbed when the legislature comes in and takes over the authority that's normally held by jurisdictions and says you will not regulate in these areas. And so I want to urge you to reject this. This bill had previously been considered dead, and it wasn't going any place, and so I would urge you to continue that status for this bill. I think it's an appropriate disposition, and I would hope that you would not move it out. And I think that local control is very important, and that we need to allow municipalities and citizens to make their own decisions. And as I say, in our community, it was a vote of the citizens, long debate, community discussion, and the overwhelming majority did support that in our community. And I think other communities should have that same privilege. And I thank you for the opportunity to put my views on the record. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for the opportunity to be here. And I'll go back to Ways and Means and vote no on some other bills.
Leave the process alone. Bill Perry.
Thank you, Chairman Starr, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bill Perry. I'm from the Oregon Restaurant Association, and I'm here to speak actually on the amendment that Representative Ross just addressed, which is the B-16 amendment I think you guys all have. I'm not here to advocate for smoking, and I'm also not here to say that every bar should have smoking. Smoking is a legal activity, and we operate legal businesses. Businesses want to offer whatever the market's going to drive, and we basically want the customers to choose what they want to attend. Basically, what the amendment does is it says the state can ban smoking in bars, and the city can address every business but bars. What we're trying to do is, I know it's been a subject for a lot of different people, to try to keep minors away from tobacco. I feel this still gives you, the local communities, an ability to discuss the issue and protect minors, but it still gives the adults the right to choose if they want to partake in a legal adult activity. This issue, I know Representative Ross said the issue was dead, and I don't know where she got those facts at, because it had bipartisan support in the House. It got at least 37 votes, and I know there, from my opinion, I think there's more than 16 votes in the Senate, so I don't know where she got that information, but it was bipartisan in the House with more than 9 Democrats supporting it. Why is this issue important to the Restaurant Association? First of all, is the economic impact. When you look at the kind of customers that bars cater, I mean, let's face it, these aren't health clubs. People drink, they smoke, they gamble. There's a lot of different things that go on here, and that's why they're close to no minors. In Corvallis, lottery revenues dropped 25% from the day the smoking ban was enacted. When you look at other states that have done smoking bans at a local community, I know Mesa, California did a study, and it said that business dropped off 25% to 35%, and it had a direct correlation to their liquor sales. In Corvallis, in the same ones that they did a study with the lottery revenues, reported tip income dropped $5 an hour for the servers there. So when you look at Massachusetts, did a study in relation to the way this affects employment, and local municipalities that did severe smoking bans employment in those establishments that were liquor-related establishments dropped about 20%. The other thing we have to look at is competitive disadvantages. Corvallis kind of sits off on its own. But when you look at Multnomah County is discussing it, Beaverton is discussing it. You guys that walk districts may know where the boundaries are in some of these cities and counties, but the average citizen, like you take the interchange between 217 and I-5, where does Washington County, Clackamas County, and Multnomah County meet? Where do the city boundaries go? There's bars and taverns on both sides of the street that could be in a different city or county. They're a block away. They could be in a different city or county. So you start to confuse the customers. You allow one of these bars to allow smoking and not the other. It's going to shift the customer base. You're going to confuse the customers, and you're going to allow one bar to provide a legal activity that another one can't. That's why local bans are so, and we're being against local bans is so important to our industry. The other issue is why now? We didn't have this problem 3 years ago. Corvallis didn't exist 3 years ago. The smoking ban, sorry. I went to school there, so it did. Then you look at Multnomah County. They just started up. The fact is that Measure 44 years ago, a few years ago, started paying these local communities to have anti-tobacco coalitions. Now, I know the state is funding these groups, and we're not opposed to what Measure 44 said was we want to educate. We want to educate people on the sales of smoking. If they want to have these local discussions, that is fine. There's nothing in the bill that says we want you to regulate, which is what they're doing with these anti-smoking coalitions, is they're trying to regulate smoking in all places. We'll let them do all places, but we want to protect the businesses that basically derive some sort of customer base from smoking activities. State already regulates these activities. The bill only talks about bars that are posted no minors. And if you have a no posted minors sign, you've got a liquor license, which the state regulates through OLCC, and looks like you've got lottery machines, which the state regulates through the Lottery Commission. These are establishments that are regulated by the states and not the counties in these perspectives. We've only asked for compromise on this issue. We have spoken up and said we will give you restaurants on a statewide or look at some statewide regulations to enhance the Indoor Clean Indoor Act. They turned that down. They said they wanted to have the local discussions. That's fine. And let us protect the one portion of the industry that really needs protection as it relates to indoor smoking. With that, I'll leave it open for questions.
Any questions?
Mr. Perry, I'd love to support your amendment. This is a lousy bill. The rest of the bill is so terrible that to say to a kid, you can't buy cigarettes against the law. I mean, really, what's next? The kids step on the scales and say, I'm sorry, you're deemed overweight, you can't buy a candy bar? Or you show a card that says, I'm not on the Oregon Health Plan, I can buy candy bars because I don't have, the public doesn't pay for my dental. This is ridiculous. Does the federal government require us to make criminals out of the kids that buy cigarettes? Is that part of it? Is that why we're doing it with the new cigarette thing? And to take away their driver's license because they're smoking?
Chairman Starbuck, or Senator Shannon, one of the issues here and one of the reasons why this bill is, I wasn't involved in the original bill. But as we just discussed on the previous bill on 2140, right now the owners of establishments are getting penalized.
I
want to address one of the issues why we're dealing with this. So, is the owner of establishments are getting penalized, much like when we did the sale to liquor, when you sell to cigarettes, they're penalizing the establishments for selling. And I don't think anybody's opposed to saying we don't want minors to have cigarettes. But what you're doing is you're penalizing the establishment for selling cigarettes, but you're not penalizing the person selling it or the person buying it. Now, if it's illegal to have cigarettes as a minor, remember, this doesn't say they can't possess it. It says they can't have two or more convictions for buying. So if they want to go out and smoke, you can do a lot of different things, but this bill only deals with the convictions for buying. And what they're doing is they're penalizing the establishment. And so if you're going to penalize the establishment for committing the crime, why not penalize the person who is also committing the crime, which is the person intending to buy? And I'm not on one side or the other on the 3492, but that's what the issue is. I think from a retail establishment, as somebody who sells liquor, You know, if you're going to say it's illegal for me to sell to a minor, then why isn't it illegal for a minor to buy?
Well, there's one reason that, you know, selling that they get in car wrecks. Maybe you should lift the penalty on the seller of the tobacco, because two wrongs don't make a right. And I understand that your frustration, but the kids that are going to smoke, going to, and some of them start at 12 or 13, and if you think taking away the driver's, whoever's making these laws, taking away the driver's license is going to stop them, I don't know, they get hooked on nicotine. And then they're going to get in wrecks because they're not insured, because they don't have a driver's license. And then the reinstatement process is a whole another big headache, because they can't even apply. And this is a major dumb, in my opinion. I just can't hate criminals, all these kids.
Senator Star, Senator Shannon, I would also say from his past experience that, remember, it says, after a second conviction, you can go up to a year suspension. I would say, in my experience with people, that when you sell alcohol to minors, they're penalizing an establishment for very, very few people. I think it's less than 15% of ever lost their license for buying it. Even though the law says shall, the judges just aren't taking it away, or they're way reducing the sentence. And I would say, remember, it's two convictions. There's diversion programs. There's a lot of different things that the DA may not go for a conviction. I would venture to say you probably won't have a lot of license.
Well, what you do is, another question, they're going to put the kids on nicotine patches instead of diversion. I just don't understand that. Unless that's taken out, right? I just...
I'll let somebody else defend the bill. The bill's not
right. Okay.
All right. We've got other witnesses. Talking to the bill. Novick, Philip Feld, and Pete Shepard.
Yes. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Pete Shepard. I'm from the Department of Justice. I'm special counsel to Attorney General Hardy Fires. We do support the engrossed House Bill 3492, though we do not support the -B16 amendments. To the bill, Mr. Chair, the issue that the bill deals with involves the practice that has sprung up of some wholesalers purchasing cigarettes that were originally manufactured for sale in the export market, re-importing those cigarettes back into the United States, affixing excise tax stamps, and then selling those re-imported cigarettes to Oregonians among others. This practice is characterized as gray marketing, and hence the name that the bill has come to be known by is gray marketing. Now, this gives rise to two problems that the bill addresses. The two key problems that caused the Department of Justice to support the bill in its de-engrossed form. The first is that cigarettes marketed for export to a distant market contain different additives, and they also contain different tar nicotine levels than cigarettes marketed for domestic consumption. And secondly, cigarettes marketed for export as opposed to cigarettes marketed for domestic consumption may not have the warning labels that are required by federal law for cigarettes marketed for the domestic market. Now, the de-engrossed bill addresses this in several ways. It prohibits the sale, or rather prohibits the affixing of excise tax stamps to products that do not comply with federal labeling statutes. Second, the bill prohibits the use of excise tax stamps on products that have been imported in violation of federal laws, which effective January 1st, year 2000, will prohibit the reimportation of cigarettes under the circumstances I've described. Third, the bill will prohibit the use of excise stamps on packages labeled for export only. And finally, the bill prohibits a practice obscuring labeling that indicates that the product is manufactured for export only. The remedy for that potential remedy for that under the bill is that the bill authorizes the seizure of product that is in violation of the provisions of the bill, and also makes the practices I've described a violation of Oregon's Unlawful Trade Practices Act, which is the basic consumer protection statute that the state has. Now, as amended by previous action, the bill does contain provisions relating to what might be described as disincentives for youth to acquire cigarettes. You've heard those described briefly. They're in Section 8 of the bill, I believe. I would simply observe that these weren't our idea for the bill. In their present form, we worked with the proponents of these provisions, and we think they're workable in their present form, though I'm not the right person to speak to the intricacies of and the arguments for why they ought to be continued in the bill. Nonetheless, we do support them, and we would support the bill with those provisions in it. We would not support the bill if the committee were to add the B-16 amendments, however. We would urge the governor to veto the bill, and we believe the governor would do so. Simply put, we agree with Representative Ross on this issue.
Chair, why would the Department of Justice support a bill with a section in it that encourages unlicensed, uninsured motorists? That's what you're doing if you take your driver's license away from them, especially for something that's totally unrelated to driving.
Mr. Chair, Senator Duke, in its original, as the youth disincentive provisions were originally crafted, they didn't allow what we believe to be sufficient flexibility to address what we perceive to be an unnecessarily harsh penalty, just as you described. We worked with the industry and the proponents of this concept to try and establish a graduated sanction so that for the first conviction, recognizing that perhaps there may be encounters that youth have that do not result in a conviction, even before they enter this graduated system that I described. For the first conviction, the court is able to, but not required, to direct the youth to participate in a variety of different forms of community service, some of which include community service specifically relating to the adverse health consequences of smoking and other tobacco products.
Do we have any statistics to show that these programs have any success rate?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, I don't have the exact statistics before it, but that particular element, but I'd be happy to supply those, the extent of the research that I do have, although not with me at the moment. That particular provision, Senator Dukes, is derived from a recommendation of the National Association of Attorneys General. That is one of the elements of what that organization, after a long period of study, concluded would be a part or could contribute to some measure to successfully deterring youth with and addressing youth who in fact had acquired tobacco products. The next level of sanction is the one I think Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, that your question addresses, and that is the license suspension. And at the second conviction, it is correct that the bill presently provides that the court must impose a license suspension. It's also correct that what that provision allows is that the court, it's in the court's discretion as to whether that suspension is from one day up to a maximum of 1 year. So the argument for the court when confronted with a youth who suffered the second conviction would be a question of proportionality. And one would expect the youth to argue that 365 days would be disproportionate, but perhaps a day or a weekend might be a more appropriate sentence.
How do you suspend somebody's driver's license for a weekend? It takes DMV a little longer than that just to process the suspension. Do you have any idea what it would cost to suspend somebody's driver's license for a week?
Mr. Chair, Senator Duke, I think there is a fiscal impact associated with the license suspension.
$5,000
for DMV alone. Mm-hmm.
Okay. I got it.
Any
Mr. Chair and committee members, I'm Philip Fell from the League of Oregon Cities. Thanks for the opportunity to appear to speak against the D-16 amendments to 3492. Well, let me tell you immediately that I barely knew 3492 existed until about an hour ago. You can ask me all the questions you would like on the substance of the bill. I don't have an answer. But with regard to the amendments, let me suggest this. As Mr. Perry noted, the circumstances recently arose, last year, a couple years ago, arose in Corvallis, in which the council voted to ban smoking in bars. And I understand his concern with that. However, let me talk to you about this issue without regard to the content of the action, because I think that whether the council voted for or against banning smoking ought not to be your concern at the state legislature. Let me suggest to you that the council followed a very, very open and reasonable process in reaching this decision. As I understand it, there was a year-long countywide task force that focused on tobacco use. I have also heard that there was more than a majority of these members who were non-smokers. The task force then presented the City Council recommendations and recommended that the council proceed to ban smoking in bars for health reasons. The city adopted the task force's recommendation, but let me point out that recognizing that there could be a financial impact on the business of their community, they delayed enforcement of the ban for 6 months and created yet another task force to see if there were any alternative actions the council could take that would protect the public health and not require any reduction, possible reduction in business, no matter how temporary. I think the council exercised a superior process in taking that action. They listened to their people. They considered the genuine concerns of an industry proposed for regulation. They looked for alternatives, and finally, they acted. Now, I do note that the Dash 16 excused the city of Corvallis from the bill's impacts. And I guess my question to you all, if I may be so bold, is I have not heard a statement of the state's interest in forbidding local governments and their citizens to take similar actions should they choose to. I'll also express that I travel quite a bit around the state, and I've been in a number of cities, and I haven't seen a lot of council must ban smoking in bars signs carried by the citizenry. But in Corvallis, that's what they have. The people in Corvallis decided that they wanted to ban smoking. That ban then was referred to the ballot by the industry, and it was sustained by a 57% vote. So certainly the people that went through this process down there are not dissatisfied. And if I need to put my testimony into any kind of context, see if that will help. Finally, I think the precedent that this bill takes, I think you don't want to establish a practice of preempting zoning regulations that are based on public welfare. I think that is a rationale that's used in a number of different actions. Let me point out that was the zoning rationale that cities have attempted to follow in zoning adult businesses. Finally, we had to move H.J.R. 52 through the process. But it's a similar rationale, I think, that underlines the two circumstances. And I would urge you that to consider that residents of any community around the state should have the right to act on an issue of local importance without fearing that simply by acting, the legislature will take their authority away to do so. They ought not to have to drive to Salem to address what is fundamentally a local issue. Mr. Chairman, committee members, I urge you to keep it a local issue and reject the amendments. Thank you. I would ask the questions about the amendments if I can.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, Tom Novick with Oregon Health Leadership Against Tobacco, which is a coalition of the Cancer, Lung, and Heart Association. I'm also speaking to the D-16 amendment in opposition. I'm going to make a couple of points very briefly. I distributed some testimony which was on House Bill 2806, which the D-16 amendments essentially are, a bill that did pass the House, and I believe is sitting in this committee. It includes a resolution from the Morrow County Court opposing the bill, a memo from the League of Cities, a memo from Christine Lundberg, a member of the Springfield City Council, some testimony from Dr. David Klewer, who's a retired oncologist and one of the proponents of the Corvallis City Ordinance, a memo from the American Heart Association, a memo from Alice Smith, who is a worker in a bar in Corvallis, who supported it. I want to make a couple of points very brief because I know it's getting late. We're opposed to the B-16 amendments. We do believe that they run roughshod over the principle of local control. Second, it will ban communities throughout Oregon from even discussing important public health efforts and deciding whether or not they at their local level want to deal with secondhand smoke. I would note that Mr. Perry noted that there's a plethora of this activity going on. He didn't mention the places where it's been defeated, like King City, where the city council debated it and decided that it wasn't for their city. I will get to the committee an op-ed written by the mayor of that city who said she doesn't like indoor smoking ordinances. But on the other hand, she also doesn't like the legislature telling her community that they don't have the ability to discuss and decide for themselves. We also believe the amendments stand public health law on their head. Traditionally, what the state has done is set a minimum level of public health but allowed local communities, if they so desire, to go beyond that. We also think, frankly, it's a search and solution of a problem. Mr. Perry talked about some of the impacts of Corvallis. We believe that if you look closely at Corvallis, the impacts are not necessarily quite as clear. You mentioned that lottery revenue went down in Corvallis. Well, interestingly enough, lottery revenues went down a commensurate measure in Benton County. And in fact, they didn't ban smoking in bars. You would think that those folks who wanted to gamble and smoke might have driven over to Philomath, but in fact, their lottery revenues were down. So were Linn County, Lane County. Some would suggest that perhaps some of the new casinos or other things would have impacted that. In addition, when you look at the payroll for the four quarters prior to the ordinance being enacted in the five licensed OLCC establishments in the city of Corvallis, and the four quarters after, in fact, payroll went up 21%. Now, 9% of that is probably attributable to the minimum wage hike, but there's another 12%. So, in fact, the idea that there are less employees or that wages were going down just doesn't wash with the records with the Employment Division. In addition, when you look at the amount of liquor sold by the OLCC in that city during the same time period, was relatively stable. So I would point out that there was a drop immediately after the law went into effect. Not really surprising when you consider that that was at the beginning of July when the students from OSU leave, and at the same time Hewlett-Packard furloughed all of their employees for 2 weeks with no pay. That may have had some correlation. So my point is that it would be inconclusive at best to suggest this has had a major impact in Corvallis. We believe that this is a decision left up to local communities, and if we come back in a couple of years and there suddenly are patchwork ordinances all around, perhaps it's an appropriate time for the legislature to say we should look at a state law. But the idea of preempting local communities from even discussing this, we believe, is a bad idea. So we would encourage you to oppose the B-16 amendments.
Mr. Chair, I neglected to mention that I have provided the committee with a photocopy of an affidavit submitted in connection with some Colorado litigation involving a similar statute that was adopted by the state of Colorado there, and it simply goes to the point of the differences between cigarettes manufactured for domestic consumption and those manufactured for export.
Thank you very much. We have Senator Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Senator Cliff Crowe from District 18. I represent Denton and Polk counties, and Corvallis is
a part of my district, very important part of my district. I think I know the people in Corvallis well, and they very seriously looked at this issue and decided that they wanted to ban smoking in certain establishments in Corvallis. The city council voted an ordinance. Then that ordinance was reaffirmed by a vote of the people in that area. And so they looked at an issue of whether or not it's desirable to have smoking in bars and in restaurants and determined that it was not a good idea to do that. It was done democratically. It was done by elected representatives in a Republican form of government. It was done democratically by the voters understanding the issue and voting on the issue. And clearly there was plenty of opportunity for both sides to present what they believed about the issue. Now, all of a sudden, here we are with an amendment to a bill at the last minute in legislative session to preempt this kind of activity, to preempt Democratic, Republican kinds of activity about an issue that's important, and to say that it can't be done that way. This is a very important issue. This issue has to do with the health of a community. And in Corvallis it was handled this way. Other communities may want to do the same thing. You're asked to preempt this with this amendment and keep other communities from exercising their Republican and Democratic rights to deal with an issue that affects health. I would urge you not to accept this amendment. And I do say that I think it's interesting that this would come forward at this late time in the session and then go forward to the legislature. And I'm sorry. I know the governor is opposed to this, and it indicated earlier when there was a bill on the House side, which eventually didn't make it through the process, that he would veto such a measure. My guess is that this would put any piece of legislation that she wanted to pass in jeopardy if you put it into it. I would just say that I'm certainly opposed to it. I think that local government is worthy of respect, and local government has looked at this issue. The people have been involved, and the people have ratified what the local government did in a democratic election. And I think you ought to just leave it alone. I suggest that you don't pass this. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Larry Harvey. I'm here on behalf of the American Cancer Society. I cannot add any comments necessarily to the issues, pro and con, of exactly what it is this bill will do, whether it's the substantive bill with regard to the Attorney General's comments or what the Restaurant Association is wanting to do. I have some suggestions, and I will limit my comments to that. And it's simply this. I understand exactly what the objective of the B-16 amendments are. I'm not certain, though, that the amendments would get you to where you want to go, or necessarily where the American Cancer Society would like for you to go, or the Restaurant Association in the way they propose the amendments. From a technical standpoint, you would need to know that, depending upon how you count, there are five or possibly six different ways that are promulgated through rules by the Oregon Liquor Control Commission as to where minor posting signs apply and how they have to be posted and where how they eliminate the presence of minors and exactly what that means. Everywhere from they can't come anywhere near to they can come in if they're with an adult, they can come in during certain hours, and it does not in any case prohibit a minor who is 18 or older from being inside those premises and working. Even if they're a licensed premise, minors are still allowed into the delivered products such as food, ice, etc. So from the standpoint of what is actually happening inside a licensed premise, and the objective of protecting children from tobacco smoke, secondhand smoke in particular, posting a minors are not allowed sign doesn't necessarily accomplish that for a variety of different reasons. Now, if rules, different rules are being promulgated as to creating a new class of no post, no minors allowed, then perhaps you could get there. There's nothing that would guarantee in this bill that the Liquor Commission would have to go back and revisit the rules and determine how they wanted to achieve that. Secondly, even if there were new rules promulgated, interior design and architecture of restaurants don't necessarily require that there be closed walls between a licensed area and a non-licensed area. In fact, I can give you an immediate example, and everyone could go out to their local restaurant or grill or whatever else and check some of these various situations out. I and my wife and daughter went to dinner just last week, and we were asked if we would like to sit in a non-smoking or a smoking area. Well, the smoking area happened to be the lounge, and given that my daughter is only 16, we were automatically precluded from sitting in the smoking area, although my choice generally is to sit in non-smoking anyway. The interesting thing about it was that we were led around to a section of the restaurant which was partitioned with a 4-foot wall from the smoking area. On the other side of that wall, just above us, was the smoking area, and we were sitting down below in the non-smoking area. Nothing prevented the secondhand smoke from the cigarette smokers in the lounge, which was posted in an area where no minors were allowed, from drifting over into the non-smoking area. That's fine. I didn't object. I had a great dinner, and we left happy. But the problem is that if, in fact, this amendment is designed to keep tobacco smoke, secondhand smoke, away from minors in restaurants, I don't see how it gets there. It wouldn't do it in the restaurants that I went to, and it wouldn't do it in a majority of restaurants that I go to. So I'm not suggesting that you accept or reject the amendments. If you're accepting them on the premise that it will protect young people from cigarette smoke, secondhand smoke in restaurants, that's illogical. It doesn't do that. And that's my only comments, and I would answer other questions if you had any.
That concludes the testimony of those signed up. Anyone else desire to testify on the bill? If not, we're going to close public hearing and open the work session on House Bill 3492.
I just, if I could make a comment, I still find the arguments on local control to be very interesting. I mean, I keep talking with different groups, and they have this concept of local control. Obviously, none of them agree with each other, such as, should a local government have the right to put stiffer penalties on various activities or various things, such as marijuana? Should it be a Class A felony in one county but not in another? I mean, there is a reason why there is state control of various things in terms of abortion or abortive procedures. Should a county be allowed to have a more restrictive or less restrictive policy? And it's interesting because you get the progressive liberals on one hand saying, yes, let's ban these certain substances, although we can't ban it because that's done at the state or federal level, so we're going to restrict it in any way we can. And then turn around and on others say, hey, we want this to be much less restrictive. And it just, I mean, there is a reason why we have a hierarchy of government. And one is to have constancy in certain key issues. And one is, this is a legal drug. Personally, I don't like it. I never have liked it. I've never supported anything having to do with tobacco. If it became illegal, I would not cry one tear. However, it is legal, and as such, I will make certain that each individual has the right to use it until it infringes upon my right. When I first came to Oregon 16 years ago, I went into a restaurant, and it had smoke all over. And from Minnesota, we had smoking and no smoking zone. And I walked up to the owner of the restaurant, and I found out who it was, and I just said, your restaurant stinks. How can you make me sit in this smoky mess? you expect me to spend my money on your food when I can barely smell it? And I walked out of the restaurant. That was my choice. And I made it. And I went to a restaurant with much less smoking. That is a decision I made with my dog. And that's how I think it should be made, not this one. So I will support, and I will actually move that D16 amendment to HB 3492.
Senator Wilde has moved the D16 amendment. Or the
H16. Yeah,
the D16 amendment, House Bill 3492. Further discussion?
No, I'm going to support the amendment.
Clerk Caldwell.
Senator Bennett?
Aye.
Senator Ricardo?
Aye.
Senator Wilde?
Aye.
Senator
Thorpe? Aye. I received the necessary majority. We've moved the amendments into the bill. I should have done that back to the nation, but that's all right.
Well, that's okay. That works well. I will move HB 2492 as amended to the floor to pass recommendation.
Senator Wilde has moved House Bill 3492 as amended. Whoa, it does have a large.
We have to hop it over to. I will withdraw that motion, and I will move that we move HB 3492 as amended to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Wilde has moved House Bill 3492 as amended to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion?
Well, it's a good place for it. I'll go for it. I heard they closed down.
Oh. All the rolls, please. Oh, this is out of hand.
Aye.
I have received a necessary majority. House Bill 3492 as the members move to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. After we will open the public hearing on House Bill 3629. We have several people signed up, and we have 30 minutes and no more for this discussion. So you can decide how you divide it up, either beforehand or after you get here. We're not going to stay here all evening to hear testimony on this bill. Where do we start? We start... Pat West. Representative Starr.
Should have permitted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Carno. Bruce Starr, for the record, State Representative, House District 3, here to testify in support of House Bill 3629. I won't take as much time as some of the previous speakers have taken on other bills. This is a relatively straightforward issue. I think what we're doing here is we're recognizing the role that public safety officers play in our state and the dangers that they incur on a daily basis when they deal with hepatitis B and C. This bill was in the House Rules Committee, on which I'm a member, and we narrowed the bill significantly in that committee, narrowed its scope through the work of Representative Kevin Mannix. I worked the bill as well and talked with local governments in my district. In doing that, I had a sunset provision drafted to this bill. I think that that's prudent and wise, and that it gives us a time period to look at this issue, see what kinds of cases we have over a period of time, and readdress it in the next session. If there's not really a problem, we could at that point let the sunset take effect, and this issue is not and would not necessarily have to continue into the future. This issue, this bill passed the House in a handily fashion. I think it had 41 votes on a bipartisan basis. Really, I just urge that you move this bill to the full Senate. I recognize that we're scheduling for a public hearing today. I would ask that the chair work closely with the Senate leadership and schedule this bill for a work session so you can move it on to the Senate floor. I think it's a good bill. It's been worked really hard, and it recognizes the work of the firefighters and the corrections officers in this state. And I think what are unique situations which they encounter blood from unknown sources, or at least from a person that they're dealing with, and without knowing what kinds of diseases are carried in that blood. So, Mr. Chair and Senator Tarnow, thank you for allowing me to testify. Appreciate it. And if you do have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them, though there's folks that will testify behind me that probably have more specific knowledge with the disease.
Thank you very much. We have Pat Webb, Bob Livingston, Susan Bob Ruff.
Mr. Chair and Senator Cano, for the record, my name is Bob Livingston, Legislative Director for the Oregon State Firefighters Council, and I'm also a firefighter here in the Capital City. I think Representative Carr did a good job of explaining the bill, just briefly what the bill does. As noted, they have worked very hard to come to what I believe is a good compromise with a bill over in the House Rules Committee and forced to the floor. What this bill does is allows for a rebuttable presumption for hepatitis B and C. As noted, it also allows for a sunset clause on the bill to see if it is actually needed or not. That is just a very gross explanation of kind of what the bill does. What I would like to do is get more into some of the substantive issues and problems that firefighters are currently experiencing. Hepatitis C as well as hepatitis B are both blood-to-blood illnesses that you contract. It's a viral illness, and like I stated, it's noted that you contract it from a blood-to-blood contact. The reason that this bill is important for your public safety officers, not only your firefighters, but your correction officers and police officers, is because of the uncontrolled environments that we work in. I can give you some personal examples of those uncontrolled environments that we're working in. It's quite common on your motor vehicle accident where you have a person that has sustained injuries where he's bleeding profusely, where there's glass cut, he's in a ditch. The windows are broken, and in your job of providing care for this person, you inadvertently touch your hand and it goes through your glove. Unbeknownst to you, he has blood on him, and all of a sudden you've had a blood-to-blood contact. Roughly about a year ago, another experience that I can have on a personal basis is even in a setting where you know you're not going to necessarily be rendering care, you still are at risk because of that uncontrolled environment. What I'm talking about is an incident where we responded to a structure fire. The goal there obviously is to protect life first, and after that then you try to sustain as little damage to the property by putting out the fire. To make a long story short, we were in there putting the fire out. It happened to be contained to a sofa. As you may know, with sofas, you need to tear those apart because of the styrofoam, and those are really tough to get out. And in the process of tearing it out, unbeknownst to me, there was roughly 8 to 10 syringes that were in this place. In more investigation, we obviously found that there was illegal drug use that was going on. That fortunately, I was not stuck by that, but it gives you an idea of some of those uncontrolled environments that your public safety officers are exposed to. Another highlight, you have written testimony in front of you that I'd like to highlight is that
they've done studies within the first 12 months, 50 to 80% of illegal IV drug users are infected with hepatitis C. Well, that in itself is a significant number. But when you expand upon that, that unfortunately because of the activities that illegal IV drug users curtail in, the frequency in which a public safety officer encounters these folks is much, much higher than other workers and in the general population assistance. You get your firefighters that will be there for the heroin overdose, the person's not breathing, and you're there to render care. The police officer gets involved with that, and I believe there's people that will talk about some of the things. And then it gets further exacerbated, unfortunately, because of their illegal IV drug use. They most notably always end up in a correctional facility, and therefore correction officers have that same potential and risk that the other public safety officers have. Further, this is exacerbated by the fact that it's a relatively new disease in regards to they've actually recognized that hepatitis C is out there. I believe that was in 1989 or 90. One of the problems that continues to occur is that people can go 15 to 20 years without showing signs and symptoms of the disease. Because of that, that causes some real problems in the current workers' compensation laws in regards to preponderance of evidence. I won't get into that. I'll allow some of these other individuals to get into that. But that alone causes problems on exactly when, where, and how you contracted the disease. It almost makes it impossible. As Representative Starr did note, there are some safeguards in this bill, not only for the employee, but for the employer as well. And before I turn it over, I would like to just quickly comment in front of you. You have a letter that, unfortunately, Dr. Zhu was not able to be here for this, but I want to put into the record a letter that you have in front of you from him. Just a brief background on the credentials of Dr. Zhu. He's an associate professor of emergency medicine at Oregon Health Sciences University. He is the EMS medical director of Multnomah County, as well as physician supervisor for the Oregon State Police and physician supervisor for the United States Forest Service Region 6. And finally, he is the chair of the State of Oregon Emergency Medical Services Committee. With that, obviously, he has a very good understanding and knowledge of the dynamics in the very highly controlled environments that our public safety officers are at risk to in regards to hepatitis C and C. And I would just like to make a few more comments that I have highlighted in this testimony, and I'll allow you to read that for yourself. But he notes that both hepatitis B and C are known occupational infectious disease hazards for healthcare and public safety personnel. The presence of these infections without other known risk factors strongly suggests that the acquisition of infectious disease is directly related to the occupation. So therefore, you have a physician that's saying that this is absolutely directly related to the occupation. He further goes on to say that most emergency healthcare workers and public safety personnel acknowledge the risk of infectious disease exposures as being one of the hazards of the profession. In turn, employers are ethically obligated to cover costs for the management of these infectious disease hazards, like any other health hazard. I think that if you can stop about and look at that for a little bit, and I won't, but really, if you'll take a look at that, I think that's a profound statement. Finally, many healthcare workers and public safety personnel have inadvertent exposures on a daily basis. And this is what I had noted earlier in the example that I gave, where you have the glove contact in the motor vehicle accident. It's not after the fact, or maybe when you're back at the station when you're taking a shower, that you notice that, hey, I cut my finger and I have some blood there. And he makes reference to those dynamic situations that we are. Finally, I'll wrap up my testimony with a quote from Dr. Zhu as well. And he just notes in his written testimony, a real problem does exist. And he has underlined a real problem does exist. Some public safety personnel have had the great difficulty in obtaining the necessary coverage for these exposures by the workers' compensation system. This has led to a delay in care, great frustration on the part of exposed firefighters, and a marked increase in stress and depression. I feel that the passage of HB 3629 would be a great advancement in the management of these claims. And with that, I'll wrap it up. Just I want to expand upon the part where he notes that this has led to great frustration and depression of public safety officers, and I unfortunately have had the experience of working with two firefighters within the city of Salem that have contracted hepatitis C and in the process have not had it covered under the workers' compensation system. And I can truly tell you that not only just the fact of knowing that you have this disease causes great anxiety, depression, and frustration, but it's further exacerbated by with the difficulties with preponderance of evidence of not having it accepted as an occupational disease, as we believe it should be, and as Dr. Zhu believes it should be. With that, I'll offer to take any questions, and if there's none, I'd like to turn it over to Susan Dabra.
I understand that we're going to go about 5 more minutes for proponents, and then we're going to hear some opponents, and we're going to be adjourning for the day. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm Susan Dobroff, Chairman Starr and Senator Tarno. Thank you for hearing us. I'm currently the legal advisor to the Fire and Police Pension and Disability Fund for the City of Portland. And I, before that, was a workers' compensation attorney for almost 9 years, representing injured workers within the state system. I provided you some written testimony, and I won't go over what I said there. I will just make a couple of points to you. One is about the fact that the Center for Disease Control in October 1998 put out information about hepatitis C. And what they said was similar to how Bob Livingston testified. Within 5 years of being a self-injecting drug user, a person is projected to be, 90% of the people are projected to be infected with hepatitis C. Within 5 years of injecting, 90% of those people are infected. The people who come in contact with them are the public safety officers. The problem with workers' compensation is that causation is always the issue. Whenever a person makes a claim for compensation. And the problem for people and the long period of incubation with hepatitis C, or the long period between getting infected and having symptoms, is that you can't track back to the specific exposure. Also, if you could track back, where are you going to find the person who infected you? They may be in jail, they may be dead, they may be long gone. And they may not be willing to test their own blood to tell you whether they have hepatitis C. We have a physician who has dealt with many of the people who have gotten hepatitis C as a result of their job, and he is telling you that he is advocating that you pass this bill. And the only other thing I would say is about the rebuttable presumption. What that means is that the worker will be assumed to have gotten the disease from their work unless there is evidence to the contrary. If a person has a history of transfusion, if a person has a history of off-work exposure, there will be evidence that can rebut presumption that you are allowing by calling it an occupational disease. The amendments that were made in the House did narrow this bill, did make it more acceptable to employers, and certainly acceptable for the employees who will be protected. And I would just add that we all, as citizens of Oregon, are protected by public safety officers. The point of this bill is to protect them, and the board that I work for, the Fire and Police Disability and Pension Board, that has 3,000 members who are police and firefighters, ask that I come testify to urge your support. Thank you.
Chair Starr and Senator Tarnow, my name is Pat West. I'm the president of the Oregon State Firefighters. I will try to make this short and sweet. The one thing I would like to point out is the A9 amendment. There was a typographical error in the bill when it was passed out of the House. It was noted on the floor. And on page 5, line 7, the word after should be deleted and the word before should be put in. It was, again, a typographical error in order to make this actually function correctly, that would need to be done. And I would like to also touch on there's been discussions as to whether or not this bill has gone before the MLAC, Management Labor for Workers' Comp Advisory Committee. And I am on MREC, and I went to the co-chairs, Bob Stifak, and Tim, Hope, thank you, and told them about our bill, and asked them if we needed to come before MREC and make a presentation, and I was told by them that it did not pertain to a system-wide change or what would fall under the statute of major legislation, and thereby the issue should be dealt with by the legislature and based on the merits of the issue itself. And in fact, that was brought up at the last MLAC legislative subcommittee, where Tim Pope and Bob Shiprack were both there, and it was affirmed that was in fact what had happened.
Appreciate that. Thank you very much. I got my list over here, and Lisa Gilliam. Yeah.
Hi, Lisa Scott-Gilliam, representing Sharing Cloud Pharmaceuticals in support of this bill. Really, the only testimony I want to give is that Sharing Cloud Pharmaceutical currently is the only company that makes a treatment for hepatitis C, so we're involved in any legislation that involves Hep C. But we've been part of most of the major studies on this bill. So I would be happy to serve as a resource on any questions that you have on the background of this disease, and also to briefly address the fiscal, some fiscal questions. Currently, the Oregon Health Plan covers hepatitis C on its prioritized list of services. They have assigned the cost of $10,200 for a year-long treatment for the combination therapy, which is recently being approved by the FDA and is showing dramatic improvement in the treatment of this disease, so that it's treated, the symptoms go away, they don't come back. Not everyone can use this treatment, but generally it is the only one available. It's not a cure, it's a treatment. But for the people who are covered by this bill, at least half of them should be able to successfully complete this year-long treatment of combination therapy, and the issue will be dealt with at that point at a cost of approximately $10,000. We have been involved in studies that show that the costs don't go away. If you don't cover it here, it's going to be covered somewhere else. It has to be addressed, and that the sooner you test and treat this disease, the better off you are financially, because there's a dramatic difference between the early detection and treatment and letting it go to the point where you have severe liver damage that could lead to some of the more expensive treatments associated with cirrhosis, cancer, and the worst case scenario being liver transplantation. So we urge your support on this bill because of the features of early detection and treatment. We think it's the fiscally responsible thing to do. Thank you.
Brian Velasquez, Mary Hopkins.
Mr. Chair, members, member of the committee, for the record, my name is Brian DeLashman. I'm representing the Oregon Council Police Association, the Association of Oregon Corrections Employees, and the Federation of Oregon Parole and Probation Officers. I have very little to add other than I want to focus just a minute on the dynamics. You heard a little bit about firefighters and the uncontrolled circumstances in which they come into contact with these folks. It's very typical for a police officer to be in a situation in which they can be exposed to blood or to needles. Senator Turner was well aware of that. It's not unusual for a police officer to be intentionally or unintentionally stuck with a needle. It may be a stop in which you ask someone, do you have anything in your pockets? a knife, a needle, or whatever, and they deny that, and of course, trying to search your stuff. It could, in fact, be used as a weapon, and a lot of times is used as a weapon in a struggle with a police officer. It's those types of situations that we're really talking about here. But the reality of what this bill is really trying to get at is that you may be over your life as a police officer in these kinds of situations multiple times, and the disease may not show up for years. And so it is nearly impossible under current workers' comp situations for you to demonstrate when you got the exposure and it was directly related to your work. That's the basis of this bill. In fact, this gets back to the base philosophy that these folks are exposed to high-risk populations, that they normally would not get this disease in any other fashion other than exposure in their work, and that, in fact, we should cover them. And the police officers, corrections officers, and parole and probation officers would much appreciate passage of this legislation. Thank you.
I will be brief as well. I'm Mary Botkin, representing AFSC Council 75. We're here today representing corrections officers, about 3,000 of them statewide, maybe 4,000 now, and some police officers. We have a rather unique situation in Oregon's prison system. Our folks are rarely exposed accidentally. They're usually exposed by inmates on purpose. Inmates throw what they call cocktails into the faces of the corrections officer, and a cocktail is made up of saliva, urine, feces, and blood. And they collect this in little cups, and then when given the opportunity, or when the opportunity presents itself, they throw it onto the officer, into the face of the officer, to purposely expose them to blood-borne diseases. And we have operated under the premise that it had to be blood-to-blood contact, and we're finding out now that it can be contracted through mucous membranes and through the eyes as well. And so our officers have been exposed and not protected, and the exposures have not always been reported or documented. But one of the things I do want to bring up, you're going to hear a lot from the opponents of the bill about the fact that they cover all the cases now. There's 40, the state will tell you there's 44 reported cases, 42 of them have been resolved. We're not talking about the general population here. We're talking about a very small group of folks within the population, public safety officers. We're not talking about every worker in the workforce. And what bothers me most about the arguments here is that what they're not telling you is they're not talking to you about the shifting of the costs. And right now, what the workers' comp insurers are very successfully doing is transferring the cost of an occupational exposure onto private insurance, private health insurance. What that means, sir, is that every one of us pays the cost. Every employer in Oregon pays the cost, because the cost of treatment is being transferred to our private health insurance companies, which means that the rate increases that we incur reflect that. This should be put on to the workers' comp system so that we can track it, so that we can get a handle on it, so we can find out how the exposures occur, where they occur, and how to treat them most effectively. And that seems to be what we don't want to do, is to put this into the area of the insurance industry where it belongs, and that is occupational disease and workers' compensation. That is where it makes sense. And that's the best place for us to keep track of the costs and to control them. And with that, I don't think I have anything more to add to what everybody else has already said, except that we strongly support this bill. There's a very few employees who need this, but they need it desperately. And, you know, anytime you want to come see what a cocktail looks like, we'll bring you into the prison, we'll show you. It's not a very pretty thing. Senator Tarno knows firsthand, I know. So, thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Messina? Squires? Lisa Trussell? Good. Yeah.
you, Mr. Chair.
One more. Maria, thank you for coming on up. Go right ahead.
I will. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Christina Squire. I'm representing the Special Districts Association of Oregon, which represents approximately 800 special districts across the state of Oregon. In addition to that, today I'm representing the Oregon Fire District Directors Association, which represents 165 rural fire protection districts and consists of approximately 825 elected officials for those boards of directors for rural fire protection districts. I think that probably the first thing that I want to say about this bill is that hepatitis B and C is currently compensable under the current workers' compensation system. I don't think I heard that yet. Right now, if you contract hepatitis B or C as an employee on the job, it is compensable under the workers' compensation system. What this legislation does is shift the burden of proof from the employee to prove that the injury was on the job to the employer, who must disprove then that the employee did not contract hepatitis B, must disprove that the employee got the job somewhere, got the injury somewhere other than on the job. So employers would be forced then to try to prove a negative. We believe that with that kind of a burden of proof shift, that employers would then be forced to dig into the private lives of employees that they have. There is a lot of statistical data about both hepatitis B and C. And according to the Center for Disease Control, which is mainly the data that I've been looking at, only 1% of hepatitis B is the risk factor. When you look at the risk factors for hepatitis B and hepatitis C, only the risk factor for being a healthcare worker for hepatitis B is 1%, and for hepatitis C it's 2%. There are many, many other risk factors involved in contracting hepatitis B and hepatitis C. Most of the data that I've looked at really focuses on healthcare workers, nurses, people who are consistently exposed, potentially exposed to blood. Also in my testimony, I've also provided you with some statistics gathered from the Oregon State Fire Marshal's Office and the Oregon State Health Division, and I'd like to point out to the committee that not all firefighters are paid. They're not always on the job. They're not paid employees. Approximately 72% of firefighters in this state, according to the State Fire Marshal's Office, are volunteer employees. So this presumption shift for the employer to disprove that the employee did not contract the hepatitis on the job would also apply to those 72%, those 7,058 volunteer firefighters who may work 5 hours a week and may never run on a fire or may never run on an ambulance call. In addition to that, not all firefighters are emergency medical technicians, and the statistics are also in my testimony. And the statistics that come from the Health Division about the emergency medical technicians also include private sector employees, and I'd like to point out that this bill does not include private sector EMTs. This is solely for public employees. In addition to that, I would like to add that according to the Center for Disease Control, of the 1% of risk groups of employees who potentially have an exposure to hepatitis to needle sticks, only 2 out of 100, according to the CDC, will test positive for hepatitis. And that's if I'm an employee, I prick myself on a needle, and it's definitely, absolutely, positively hepatitis C infected needle. Only 2 out of 100 will develop hepatitis C. Also provided you with the statistics that I've received from the Department of Business and Consumer Affairs, and found it interesting that the proponents cited that potentially there was a cost shift to health insurance. Potentially, yes, I guess there would be a shift, that employers would be shifting the cost to health insurance if there were claims that were being denied.
From the information I've received from the DCDF, and the figure that I've got was 44, but I've been told that that is a higher number. There have been, since 1988 to 1999, there are 44, which they told me is now 46, 46 claims for hepatitis were made. Only two of those claims have ever been denied of the 46. And those two claims that were denied were not public safety workers. And the two claims, are, and of the 46, two claims were filed by public safety workers, and they were both accepted. Information from the Special District Insurance Services, which represents approximately 220 of the rural fire protection districts in the state, we have never been ordered to accept a hepatitis claim. We have never had an employee. We test if there is a documented exposure, and we test each employee. We have never had an employee contract hepatitis B or C. In addition to that, the testimony from the Oregon Fire District Directors Association essentially outlines what we feel qualifies as a ballot measure 30 mandate upon local governments. Some of the information contained in that testimony shows you some data from some very small rural fire protection districts that quotes their current workers' compensation premium and the level of threshold that would be required to meet that ballot measure 30. One of the proponents talked about the early detection of hepatitis B and C decreasing costs. Nothing in this bill requires early detection. In fact, it grandfathers current existing employees into the system. There is no baseline testing for current employees. So I fail to see where there's any early detection for current employees. In addition to that, there is a cost issue for employers, but this is more importantly a policy discussion that needs to take place about conflicting data that exists on where hepatitis is contracted, how it is contracted. Some of the data that I've examined, up to 30% of hepatitis C, no one knows where it came from. And with all due respect, Senator Starr, Representative Starr was good enough to try to work with us and the members of the House Rules Committee and the proponents and try to make the bill a little bit better by adding a sunset onto it. I wish Senator Wilde were here. I sit in the Revenue Committee almost every single day, and Senator Starr sits on the Senate Revenue Committee, and I spent probably 5 days in the House Revenue Committee examining all of the sunsets that currently exist on pieces of legislation for property tax exemptions. And when the bill, they repealed several of those sunsets this session and on the House side, and then sunsets that were not even being used were then extended later. So I think it is a noble attempt to try to put a sunset on a piece of legislation, but not a piece of legislation that creates an automatic, that creates a rebuttable presumption that for such a policy change and shift, that through doing trial by fire with a sunset just isn't warranted in our opinion. Also, one of the proponents brought up uncontrolled environments that public safety officers are working in, and I provided you with some testimony from Clackamas County Fire District Number 1. I'd like to point out to the committee that under the bloodborne pathogen standard that OROSHA has adopted and fire districts are required to annually train their employees on, those standards require that employers educate their employees about the potential exposures to bloodborne pathogens and adopt what's called universal precautions to minimize the exposure. So employees are being educated by their employers about the potential that exists for this exposure to bloodborne pathogens. Also, one of the proponents stated that public safety officers are at a higher risk of exposure than other employees. The data that I've reviewed clearly indicates that healthcare workers are at a much greater risk of exposure to bloodborne pathogens. And also, the proponents have stated that they have a difficulty in meeting the preponderance of evidence standard. And I would submit to you, if employees who under the bloodborne pathogen standard are supposed to report to employers that they had some sort of potential exposure, those exposures are then documented and kept on file, shifting that preponderance of evidence standard when there is no documentation for other potentials that may be out there in a person's private life would be unreasonable and impossible for an employer to try to disprove that an employee did not contract that hepatitis while not on the job. Also, the City of Portland Police and Firefighters Pension Fund representative stated that some people, victims that are involved in motor vehicle accidents that may be hepatitis B or C positive, may not be willing to allow you to test their blood. This session, House Bill 3044, that has, which I believe has passed both houses, we support it, that requires an expedited process, legal process, for the compelling of testing of victims that have exposed, that potentially could have exposed employees to bloodborne pathogens, including HIV, and we, that burden for the cost of the testing of the victim, to shift it onto the employer, and we supported that. We believe that that's a good public policy. If people do not want to submit their tests, we should have some sort of expedited legal process for that, and we should bear the cost of that because we believe our employees need to have that data. And I think probably in light of the time, I will just urge your opposition to this legislation. Mr. Chair, Senator Kino, I'm Lisa Trussell with Associated Oregon Industries, and I'm here today in opposition to House Bill 3629. Just briefly, this bill is a significant shift in how a claim is addressed, and it shifts the burden from the person filing the claim to the employer, as Hasina indicated. This bill in the House, AOI did not oppose because we were waiting for it to go through the Management Labor Advisory process. And it was after the House, the bill had already passed out of rules, which I sit on that committee with Pat West and others, that I was made aware that someone had determined that the NLAC committee was not going to be reviewing the bill. Who made that determination is unclear, as there's no minutes reflecting that. And in conversation and a note I got today from the management co-chair, Ken Pope, he doesn't recall any discussion on the bill. Be that as it may, though, the bill is originally drafted probably did have a narrower scope of impact, but as it's been amended, it addresses now how every hepatitis claim, B and C, will be addressed, regardless of whether it's filed by a safety officer or not. So I think that it has a broader policy impact than maybe was originally intended, and it deserves a full discussion as to what workers exactly are in danger of contracting this. As Hasina pointed out, that we've had OROSHA standards on bloodborne pathogens going back, I think, to at least 1991 and possibly sooner, and it requires not only documentations of exposures, but it requires medical evaluation and follow-up evaluation. And so that's your record that shows there was an exposure. The information that Hasina provided you with the 44-46 claims from DCPS, I think, is kind of telling in that if this is a problem where there are a significant number of denials, someone must have that information. There's got to be a record of how many claims were filed and how many of those that were filed were denied and ultimately denied even after litigation. Workers' comp system provides a litigation process to resolve disputes about compensability. And we haven't seen anything that supports that there's a huge problem. Now, the issue of hepatitis C and C has significant impacts. And it's an issue that people are very concerned with, and well, they should be. But there's been nothing shown to demonstrate that people are being denied access to the system. In fact, the information that was in your packet from DCDS is that all but two of the claims filed were accepted. So my question is, where's the problem, and does this bill address it? This is a huge policy change, and in fact, in the late 80s, and I can't remember when exactly, but we had a situation in Oregon where if you couldn't prove another reason or disprove a cause for a disease or illness, then it must be work-related. And we got rid of that. It was known as the Sherlock Holmes rule of evidence. And we got rid of that in the late 80s. And what this bill does is it reverses that trend. And then you have to try and disprove that something didn't happen, although already if you're following the OSHA rules, you've got the documentation that the incident occurred. You may not test positive immediately, but you're going to have the test after the exposure, and then there's follow-up tests to see if you have contracted the disease. And so for those reasons, and basically we haven't seen any compelling evidence to suggest that these claims are routinely being denied or not provided for, we see no reason in passing this bill without thoroughly analyzing exactly what the impact of hepatitis C and C is on the workplaces of Oregon and the exposures of the various workers, not just the emergency workers, but janitors and housekeepers and healthcare workers as well.
Thank you very much.
So, Mr. Chair and Senator Tarnow, my opposition as the Director of Risk Management for the City of Portland, Fred Cuthbertson, is not in any way trying to diminish coverage for our public safety people. It's, as already stated, there is coverage in the workers' compensation laws, and many have quoted the National Center for Disease Control, and they indicate that only 5% of the workforce contracts hepatitis C through the occupational exposures. That means that if we pass this bill, that 95% of those that have not been identified will automatically have this presumption, which shifts the burden of proof to the employer. I just wanted to say too that it has been stated many occupations have this exposure, and that's well documented. For the City of Portland, my take on this and what has been stated from the Workers' Comp Division here is that if it's not fixed, I mean, if it's not broken, don't fix it. It doesn't sound like anything's broken. The majority of our folks, our public safety people, are under the Fire and Police Pension Fund in Portland, but we do have a number of officers and firefighters that are still in our program. And I looked for the last 5 years of all the claims that had any blood exposure in that public safety group that we do insure, that there were 11 cases and there were only 2 denials, which kind of bears out what everybody else is saying, that it's really not broken and there is coverage. And so what is the issue here? The point to which everyone else has addressed, I also looked at our other bureaus, and the Parks Bureau had 14 bloodborne issues. Environmental Services, which is wastewater treatment and sewers and so forth, they had 4, and Transportation had 1, and the Water Bureau had 1. So there are other people that are exposed, and I think the ambiguous thing here is that, and the thing that we're focusing on is that there are other ways to transmit hepatitis B and C other than blood, and so I think that's an issue that ought to also be explored in terms of whether it's work-related or not. So the City of Portland, basically, I'd like to go on record as opposing the bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Additional questions? We've got one more witness.
Good evening. Maria Keltner. I'm representing the League of Oregon Cities and Association of Oregon Counties, and I will simply state that both organizations are opposed to House Bill 3629. I think the record is fairly clear about the reasons, and we would not repeat them on the record for you.
Thank you very much. That concludes the testimony. The witnesses we have, we've exceeded the time limit, which is all right with me. I didn't have a committee here that
didn't ask me my opinion.
Mr. Tarnow, do you have any testimony you want to submit on?
No, do the late hour, Mr. Chair. I'll keep quiet.
Okay.
very important issue, and I appreciate the level of the debate on the issue. We are working with leadership to see if there are any further amendments might be developed. You might be encouraged to talk with Senator Scherfler or myself, and we'll see if this bill gets a further hearing or no. With that, we conclude the public hearing on House Bill 3629, and we return the Senate Committee on Public Affairs.